This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We've all been following the troubles that plagued the Charlotte School of Law. Those troubles ended in the closing of the state's largest law school. But behind the headlines, behind the stories, there are people who have been seriously and negatively impacted by the failure of the school. Many of them are in the middle of their law school careers with no place to go to finish them. Others are straddled with a mountain of college debt with nothing to show for it. Was the American Bar Association thinking of them when they rejected a plan to allow the few remaining students, about 100, to finish their legal educations there? Was the state attorney general thinking of the students when he ordered the schools closed? Will the Federal Department of Education think of students and heed the attorney general's call for loan debt forgiveness? We're going to talk about that in the first part of the program today. We're joined by Brian Clark, an assistant professor of business law at Western Carolina University and former Charlotte School of Law professor. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the program. You there?
Be here.
Oh, there. Very good. In our Spirit Square studio is Lee Robertson, an attorney at Robertson & Associates and president of the Charlotte School of Law Alumni Association. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
Get a little closer to that microphone. It's your only friend in the room. And Lisa Worf, who has been following this story for WFAE News. Welcome back again. Good to see
you. Thanks for having me.
Lisa, let me begin with you. This failure of the Charlotte School of Law came to light about a year ago when the school was put on probation and lost federal loan money. Following that, leadership at the school changed more times than I can count. Were they trying to fix the problem, reverse the probation, restore the loan money? Was that what was going on in that interim period?
Yes, they were trying to restore the federal loan money. So initially, there was some wonder whether they would come out with a plan that would basically wind down the operations of the school or go ahead and try to get that federal loan money restored and, you know, pin their hopes on the Trump administration that they had a better shot of that.
Yeah. Why were they unable ultimately to do any of that?
Well, the Department of Education said, basically, we'll restore your federal loan money, but you have to have all of these things. And they were pretty stiff conditions, including a $6 million line of credit. And that just didn't happen. They were not able to meet all those things.
And when you say they, are you talking specifically of the Charlotte School of Law or their parent company and holding company?
I'm talking about the Charlotte School of Law, but sure, there's, you know, they are owned by another company, Infolaw.
Right. Right.
So they operate two other schools. Right. But right now, you know, the discussion has been Charlotte School right. of Law.
So this month, a double whammy hit the school. The American Bar Association rejected their teach-out plan, which would have allowed about 100 remaining students to finish at the school. And then North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein revoked their license to operate. Were these two things connected?
Well, and so actually what the ABA rejected wasn't a plan to wind down the operations of the school. It was actually they did not submit, according to the ABA, a plan to wind down those operations. They submitted a plan to stay open. And basically the ABA said to them, look, you know, this is not based on reality right here. We invite you. You can submit another plan in the coming months that realizes and recognizes those realities right now. And so what they rejected was a plan to stay open.
So what power does the ABA have over law schools and over a privately operated law school? Simply that they won't recognize the graduates as having gone to an accredited school? Is that,
yeah, I mean, it's partly an accreditation thing. So back in November, what they did was put the school on a two-year probation and, you know, gave them things that they had to work on, including, you know, getting up the scores of students they accepted and working on their bar passage rates. And then right after that, the Department of Education said, we see problems. And for those reasons that the ABA recognized, we're taking away your federal loan money.
So were these two things, the ABA's rejection and the Josh Stein, the attorney general, saying we're taking away your license, were these connected in any way? Did one precipitate the other?
Well, so it was kind of three columns here that really, I think, made the school have to close at this point. And so you had, for example, the UNC Board of Governors was the school's state licensor. And in order to operate, they need that license from the state. And so they set this deadline that said, their license was expiring. They said, okay, you need to have all this done by August early August, including get your federal loan money reinstated and get the ABA to approve a plan for you going forward, whether that's, you know, if you plan to stay open, and then we'll grant you an operating license, we'll renew it. And that didn't happen. All these things came together.
Lee Robertson, what's your reaction to all this? You're a former student there. You've seen. Were you aware of any troubles at the school while you were a student? When did you graduate?
I graduated in 2012.
Okay, so it's been, 5 years. Were you aware of any of these problems? Were they going on then? And what's your reaction to all of this?
The Alumni Association generally was aware, particularly in more recent years, that there were some issues at the law school. We were not fully aware of the depth of those problems and the seriousness of the situation. Mm-hmm. We're all, I think, uniformly frustrated and sad that this has happened to our law school.
Brian Clark, you taught there. I'm not sure when you left, but you're now at Western Carolina University. When did you leave the school?
I left at the end of July of 2016.
Okay. So the faculty by that point knew what was going on, right?
Well, we knew some of it. We didn't even when I left in July of 2016, we didn't really know the depth as Lee said a second ago. Mm-hmm. We didn't realize the depth of the ABA's concerns and involvement. I mean, we had concerns that we regularly communicated to the administration, but we didn't realize how sort of formal and external the concerns were.
Closing this school and stranding a lot of students, and we'll talk about whether or not this puts in jeopardy the legitimacy of people who have diplomas. Does it put in jeopardy those diplomas? Does it lessen those folks' chance of being successful in their careers? We'll talk about that. But given the dramatic nature of this, closing the school, do you see that as the only alternative here? Was that the only alternative they had at their disposal, Brian?
I don't think it was. I mean, you know, the owners of, well, and I'm talking about the owners of the Charlotte School of Law. You know, there were, I think, any number of times where if they had been willing to recognize the reality that they were facing, and you know, Lisa's mention of the ABA's conclusion about the school really not seeming to accept reality, you know, I think that's one of my overarching feelings from this whole ordeal, is that the people who owned the school, the Infolaw folks, were never willing to be realistic and understand the reality in which they were operating. If they had, I mean, I think there are lots of things that could have been done to try to right the ship.
I don't know if you had an opportunity to talk to anybody in Infolaw or anybody running the actual school behind the scenes here, Lisa, and I don't know if you can answer this question.
And I have not. Okay. I have tried several times.
Ah, okay, because we had one of the interim deans on the program.
I have spoken, yes, I have spoken to one of the interim deans, Scott Broyles.
He came in hoping to be able to accomplish something and then left because he said he couldn't accomplish anything. And he alluded to the fact it was the higher ups that caused that problem. You are President Lee of the Charlotte School of Law Alumni Association, and all these troubles coupled with the school's forced closing here and what we've heard about students being ill-prepared to take the bar, etc. A lot of people would assume from hearing all this news that this was a terrible school that gave people a terrible education. Was it?
It was not. And it's unfortunate that what has happened to the school distracts from the good work that our alumni are doing every day in Charlotte, in North Carolina, and across the country. We've got 2,300 alumni who are making a difference wherever they live. And so to say that we received a bad education is not true at all. For those of us who are practicing attorneys, we took and passed the same bar exam.
Your dad's a lawyer.
He is.
Why did you choose that as a place to go to school to get your law degree?
I grew up in Charlotte, mm-hmm. so it made sense to me. I was proud that Charlotte had a law school, mm-hmm. and I wanted to be back in Charlotte. This was the place to go.
And are you convinced that the education that you have is as good as any that you could have gotten at similar schools around the country?
Absolutely.
Brian, you taught there. One of the problems that we know the school had was the fact that they were admitting students who had little chance of successfully completing the bar exam. They weren't prepared to be in law school. I'm not sure what that means, because it seems to me that I know you take the LSAT to see if you have an aptitude for this, but once you're in, you can learn, it would seem to me. But it's alleged the school was taking advantage of people who were hoping to graduate and hang up a shingle when they were actually unprepared to embark on a legal education. So would that be accurate? You had students in front of you in the classroom. Would that be accurate?
I think it is accurate in part. I mean, there were the population of students at Charlotte had a lot of variety of folks from different backgrounds, from different ethnicities, with different educational careers to date, and we had a lot of really great students, and we had a lot that honestly should not have been admitted. And
why were they admitted? Why were they admitted then?
I think in a word, money. That's the money and the corollary of that, greed.
If they shouldn't have been admitted, why couldn't they catch up?
Well, I think the most honest answer is that just not everybody has the intellectual firepower to be a lawyer. It's not an easy area. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of ability to recall information. It takes extraordinary writing ability. It's just not for everybody. And I think when the school started, the idea was, well, let's give people a chance to succeed. But there always have to be limits.
Go ahead, Lisa.
And I mean, when you look at how the school began, it began small, and their first or second class had pretty good bar passage rates. I mean, I believe it was about 87% or so. And then around shortly after Lee graduated, 2013 or so, is where you saw acceptance just balloon. So that it was very quickly the biggest law school in the state at more than 1,000 students. And then you started, in those subsequent classes, you started seeing bar passage rates really slip, to the point where I believe the last bar passage rate was somewhere in the 20s, mid-20s or so.
We've heard so much about the mission of the school being giving an opportunity to people who would not have been able to go to law school elsewhere. Was that the mission of the school, or was that an altruistic ancillary effect of opening this school?
Well, I think it was part of the mission. Part of the mission was, we believe we can take students who might not be admitted to a traditional law school, provide them with the tools and the resources they need to be lawyers. And for a lot of people, that worked. The school also had a very traditional, we accept high-performing students from undergraduate institutions, give them legal education, and let them go out and take the bar exam or whatever they want to do. But to be clear, I think that the faculty was top-notch, was first-rate, and I think the education that all of us received, even up until very recently, was excellent.
Lee Robertson is an attorney now. He got his law degree, and he's a practicing attorney at Robertson & Associates. He's also the president of the Charlotte School of Law Alumni Association. Brian Clark is here, a former professor there, and Lisa Ward from WFAE News. When we come back, what happens to these students who are essentially stranded? Is there a lifeboat for them? Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Volkswagen of Concord, offering a summer selection of vehicles new and used. Details at Hendrick Volkswagen of Concord, at the Hendrick Automall Concord Mills, or Hendrick VW of Concord.com. And Novant Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, providing patients with customized care and treatment plans designed to help them regain mobility to live life with a full range of motion. More at novanthealth.org/motion. Americans have been trying to have an honest conversation about race. They're hard to have, and often not successful. Could the media facilitate that conversation? What has been its role in influencing our thoughts on race, from early portrayals of African Americans to what we see on today's news? Have negative representations outstripped positive ones? panel of journalists talks about that and more on this program tomorrow at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the top 20% of this country, not just the top 1%, is leaving everyone else behind. We'll talk with the author of Dream Hoarders. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Stay tuned for On Point from 10 till noon, following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the late Charlotte School of Law, what happens next to the students, to the faculty in some cases. Lee Robertson is here, the president of the school's Alumni Association, Brian Clark, an assistant professor at Western Carolina University in their School of Law, former professor at the Charlotte School of Law, and Lisa Wharf from WFAE News. I've been reading, and we've been told that there's been a surprising shift in the land about the number of lawyers that are needed out there. At one point, you couldn't mint enough new attorneys, and now evidently there are far too many. And the Charlotte School of Law had difficulty in turning out students who could pass the bar, at least on the first or second try. For those that did pass the bar, ultimately, how many people in your organization or in your class, or I guess in your organization, the Alumni Association, had trouble passing the bar and then had difficulty finding a job?
We don't have exact metrics on that. I think, at least from my class, our bar passage rate was at the state average. I'm not sure exactly what it was, 75% in that area. As far as finding a job goes, I think that, again, most of us were successful there. Those of us who wanted to practice law found those jobs. Now, how long it took differed depending on the person, what their experiences were.
But if you leave school with a law degree, do you need to work for a firm? Can't you just start your own, hang your shingle out and get a storefront?
Having a JD allows you a lot of things. You can start your own practice if that's what you want to do. You can join an existing firm. A lot of our graduates, though, were not interested in the traditional practice of law. A lot of them were working in other careers, that were going back to law school to do other things. I have friends who teach. I have friends who use their law degrees as they run businesses here in town and all over the place.
They just wanted a legal background for whatever else they were doing.
That's right. It's a very versatile degree, and so there was a lot of there are a lot of things you can do with it. And so Charlotte, in particular, in the programs that offered, provided an opportunity for a lot of these people to receive that education that they couldn't otherwise receive it. We had evening programs and part-time programs and really in an attempt to reach people.
But the thing is, you know, once you go through a law school and you come out with that much debt, you got to really look for a job that can help you pay off that debt.
Yeah.
And that was the difficulty, because I think, you know, a lot of graduates were maybe getting jobs that required legal background, but they weren't enough to start really making a dent in that loan.
Brian, how difficult will it be for those with degrees from a closed law school to get a job, or a first job at least, in the profession?
From what I've heard from alumni, that as soon as the death throes, let's call them, of the law school began, even firms in Charlotte and the Charlotte area that had hired Charlotte School of Law alums in the past, who have done very well, refuse to even consider people from Charlotte going forward.
And these are not just major firms; these are mid-level firms, smaller firms.
Yeah, these are medium-sized and smaller firms, which is honestly, I think, is unfair to the students. As Lee said, they have JDs; they've passed the same bar exam as someone who went to Harvard or Yale.
Is that the school is passing the bar the scale? That's the test. It's not where you went to school. It's the fact that you passed the bar, whatever your score is. Is that the test?
Well, it should be. You know, the law is a fairly credential and prestige focused profession. So, you know, and that just it is what it is. You know, part of I think the ills of the law school had to do with the timing. The Great Recession hit the legal industry far harder than any recession has in the last several decades, really caused some systemic shifts in the practice of law, which, you know, reduced the demand for new lawyers, which made it harder for new graduates, all those kinds of things. So, you know, there was some market forces at work. But then, of course, when the applicant pool started shrinking, Charlotte was growing. And so they have a shallower pool of applicants to fit, and we're filling 500 seats with a historically small applicant pool, which was just catastrophic.
It has been said on this program in the past, and it's been said again today, that the Charlotte School of Law gave people an opportunity who may not otherwise have been able to get a legal education to get one. Is that simply because they were accepting anybody and everybody? Because it costs $44,000 a year. I don't know what it costs to go to Western Carolina to get your law degree, or to Duke University and get your, or UNC Chapel Hill. But $44,000 a year sounds like a pretty significant chunk of change. Is it?
It's a lot of money.
Certainly it is.
And one of the highest. I mean, it's up there as far as tuitions in the state for law schools.
So did those students get what they paid for, and were they there primarily because they couldn't get into another school?
I don't know if the students who, you know, came to Charlotte, if Charlotte was their only option. I really don't.
Right.
But they certainly, all of the information about Charlotte's bar passage, job placement, you know, it's all cost. It's all publicly available information. So I mean, at some point, you know, law students who are college graduates, you know, they have they bear some responsibility for, making their own choices.
Right around the time of the announcing of the closing of the school, Lisa, you spoke with some students, among them a fellow named Louis Gonzalez, who was set to complete his degree after wrapping up a research project due just a week after the announced closing. And here's what he told you.
These 3 years have cost me in ways that the law school could never even possibly comprehend. And to hear that they've, you know, hung us out to dry is very disconcerting. It's disappointing. It's painful.
Have you heard whether he's found any options?
So I actually texted with him yesterday this week, and it sounds like on his actual, when he goes online on his actual record, it shows that he graduated.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to verify that that is indeed the case. But I did hear from, there was a letter from a UNC administrator that said that they were going to allow, even though the school is closed, it looked like a bunch of students completed their coursework for the summer classes, and it sounded like 8 were going to be allowed to graduate.
What are their options, Lee, and what is your organization, the Alumni Association of the Charlotte School of Law, doing to help these people who are essentially stranded, many of them?
They are, and we're doing whatever we can. In many cases, though, there's just unfortunately not much we can do. To the extent that we can assist these students find new places to finish their education, we're trying to do that. We're hopeful that most of them will be able to transfer and end up at another school and finish their education.
If you're transferring credits from a school that came under fire because they were bringing in people who couldn't qualify and trying to graduate students who had to take one or two or three attempts at passing the bar, what does that do to the transferability of those credits, Brian? Does it call them into question? Can schools say, well, you went to the Charlotte School of Law, so I'm not sure these are legitimate or what you actually learned? What goes on there behind the scenes?
It should not affect the transferability of the credits in the slightest. Any credits earned at Charlotte School of Law were earned at a ABA-accredited law school and should be completely transferable to any other school based on that school's policies. So some schools only allow, you know, a certain number of credits to transfer, whether the person is transferring in from Charlotte or Yale. Others allow far more credits. So,
will law schools who are open to admitting new students, will they give these students some sort of special consideration, realizing that they are in the middle of their law school careers and essentially have few options at their disposal? Will they give them special consideration?
I think that's up to each school individually. I think Charlotte, as students started transferring out, in the spring and over Christmas of last year, one of my colleagues was actually keeping track, and something like three dozen or more law schools around the country accepted transfers from Charlotte, and a number of schools who did give special consideration to try to, you know, to try to help out, and admitted quite a few transfers.
Listen.
So, you know, I think the other law schools in the, especially in the area, have you know, sort of stepped up to try to help out. But you know, the students like Louis who were you know, a small number of credits away from getting their degrees, you know, those were the folks that were really stuck.
Lisa.
And it was intriguing, you know, right around the time back in December, January, when the federal loan money was yanked, I heard of a couple law schools that did accept almost all Charlotte School of Law credits. You know, for example, Appalachian was one I heard took Appalachian School of Law, different from
Appalachian
State. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Took a couple students, and they have a very low bar passage rate. But, you know, in some ways it was – could have been an advantage for them taking some of the top Charlotte School of Law students.
What I'm hearing you say is it's not going to be a great big problem. They will not be set back. In other words, they'll transfer X number of credit hours at that school will equal X number of credit hours at a new school. They won't have to be backpedaling and do some catch-up. What about the faculty? How difficult will it be for members of the faculty? I'm not sure how many members of the faculty there were toward the end, but how will they be viewed by other institutions, and are there jobs for those people? Brian?
Well, you know, certainly in legal education, I think it's very, very hard to get a job. It was very hard for folks to get jobs at Charlotte because of the number of people seeking those jobs. So for the faculty, most of my former colleagues who left either have gone back to practice or, they've had to relocate to stay in a teaching position.
So Charlotte School of Law started 11 years ago. And as you mentioned, Lisa, they started very small and then they grew in size very quickly. But these chronic problems with admissions and curriculum and test scores on the state bar exam, I think, and sometimes they were the state's lowest scores on the state bar exam, I think those problems had been around for a while. So how did they grow so quickly in the face of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. But they, you know, I think part of it was taking students that a lot of other schools wouldn't take.
Right.
That's part of it. And then you certainly had, you know, a contingent of people who, you know, they are captives in Charlotte, you know, and they have jobs, you know, that they have to keep on going through. And this made sense, you know, Charlotte School of Law, get a law degree as you're making your way through your career.
So, Brian and Lee, from what you know about the school, about how it operated, about the problems that you experienced when you were there, the problems that you were aware of when you were there, did the problems originate from the parent company, Infolaw, or did the problems originate within the administration of the Charlotte School of Law? Lee.
Professor Clark and I may differ on this. I know the administration here in Charlotte. They care very much for the students and for the success of the school. Where the problems originated from, I wasn't involved in those conversations. The Alumni Association tried to be involved, but didn't really have that opportunity. More of the blame, I'm sure, lies in Infolaw down in Florida than it does here locally.
And Attorney General Josh Stein, says he's written Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos advocating that she expand loan forgiveness protections for the students of Charlotte School of Law who qualify. I'm not sure what qualify means, but how many students might that be, and what is the likelihood that would happen, Brian?
I don't think anybody really knows for sure. I mean, there certainly, I know hundreds of former students, Lee may actually know better, who have applied for loan forgiveness from the Department of Education. You know, how many might qualify and what department ultimately determines about that. I think Secretary DeVos and her staff are probably the only ones who could answer that. But, you know, to answer the question you asked a moment ago, Mike, you know, it really was, I think, as Lee indicated, you know, most of the problems were from NFLAW and the local administration of the law school, to the extent that the president of the law school was always an NFLAW appointee. So NFLAW installed the president of the school without input from the school. So that person was rowing the boat from NFLAW's point of view.
And back to the loan forgiveness, that's a sticky situation, because if you get loan forgiveness, you have to basically give up all your credits. So it's not transferable.
So it's a trade-off.
So it's a trade-off for sure. And, wow. You know, if you withdraw, the rule is if you withdraw 120 days before a school closes, then you qualify for that loan forgiveness.
So we have 3 minutes left in this segment, so we have to have fast answers here. But it may take a year for the Federal Department of Education to decide on or finalize a process for loan forgiveness. In the meantime, do those students have to continue paying on the loans, or do they stop paying and does interest accrue? How does it work?
I'm not sure for those students who are currently enrolled. And to be clear, there's also a separate program to have your loans forgiven later on if you were graduated outside that time window. I'm not sure.
So Fred emails an idea for a senior project for Charlotte School of Law students, if there are such things now as senior projects at a defunct school, collectively suing the parent company and its principals out of business. If they succeed, he says, they should be granted bar passage. Well, in fact, a group of students is suing InfoLaw System and Sterling Capital Partners, and the lawyer representing them says the students, quote, were lied to and manipulated. They gave money to an entity that pocketed it and gave them nothing in return. Is that accurate? Is that defensible in a court of law? Do they have a case, Brian?
I don't think that they were given nothing in return. You know, and students like Lee and others like him, I think have, you know, got what they paid for, at least in the form of a legal education. Were other students lied to get them to enroll? I don't know.
And this is, they're also the subject of an attorney general investigation for consumer protection laws.
This is a for-profit school, was a for-profit school, and the company that owns them still operates two for-profit law schools, one of which I think is in similar straits. What does this say about for-profit higher education versus more traditional forms?
That it's fraught with problems.
Buyer beware?
Certainly.
Because somebody said before you apply to one, you should make sure they have a line of credit. Because in this case, they were asked to have a $6 million line of credit that they couldn't come up with to stay open. I don't know if that's accurate
that
or not.
That they didn't come up with.
Right, exactly.
Not that they might not necessarily have been unable to, but they didn't.
Brian Clark is a former professor at the Charlotte School of Law. He's now an assistant professor at Western Carolina University. Lee Robertson is an attorney now at Robertson & Associates and the president of the Charlotte School of Law Alumni Association. And Lisa Worf from WFAE News. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk about Wells Fargo. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Museum of History, presenting the 6th annual Mad About Modern Home Tour, Saturday, September 9th, featuring 7 mid-century modern homes in the South Park area. Information at madaboutmodern.com. And UNCC College of Arts and Architecture, with a reception September 8th for artist Bob Trotman at the Projective Eye Gallery, artistic expression of power with wood, motion, and light. More at arts.uncc.edu. Those at the top of the income ladder, a group commonly called the 1%, continue to do pretty well. But less has been said about the 20%, those in the upper middle class. Economist Richard Reeves says they are hoarding the American dream. And they'll be talking about that in 20 minutes. With Tom Ashbrook during On Point. We're going to come back, and we're going to talk about Wells Fargo in just a moment.
The news moves fast, faster than ever, it seems. Morning Edition slows the news down, adds context, makes sense of it all, tries to help you figure out what's really important. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
News throughout the day, on air at 90.7 WFAE and online at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Another organization that has deep ties to Charlotte has been experiencing its own ongoing series of woes, Wells Fargo. The bogus account scandal badly tarnished the bank's reputation. It resulted in the resignation of key bank officers, including President John Stumpf. Recently, other stories of questionable behavior surfaced, and now the bank's chairman, Stephen Sanger, has headed for the exit. Even those departures don't match what Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren called for in her blistering critiques of the bank's behavior. But what impact has this latest resignation and the newest revelations had on the bank's effort to rebuild its image? We're joined now by Dion Roberts, banking reporter for the Charlotte Observer, who's been on this program many times to talk about this. Welcome back.
Good to be back.
Nice to have you here. And he's in our studio joining us by phone, Stacy Cowley, who covers finance for the New York Times. Thank you for joining us as well, Stacy.
Hi there.
Hi. These problems with Wells have been going on for, I think, about a year now. They've been going on far longer than a year. We've known about them for a year. And this latest shakeup on the board with Chairman Stephen Sanger stepping down effective January 1st follows his receiving a pretty low percentage of the votes at the shareholder meeting, about 56% of the votes. Why this resignation now, though?
I'd say this isn't a surprise. He is reaching retirement age this year, so one way or the other, he was likely to step down this year. And also, he indicated at the shareholder meeting that he was probably going to do it sooner rather than later. I think he recognized that there is a desire for change on that board.
Hmm. So he's been on the board, I believe, since 2003. How long has he been chairman?
He was named chairman in October when John Stumpf, who was chairman at the time, stepped down. And when Stumpf left the company, mm-hmm. What the company did was split the chairman and CEO roles, which means that for now, at least, the chairman and the CEO have to be two different people.
And So he's been on the board since 2003, and that means he was on the board of directors during the entire time that we know, at least that we know about, that this bogus account scandal was taking place. If that wasn't big enough to take him down along with President John Stumpf, why?
I think there's been just this, as one analyst described it, sort of a drip of revelations at Wells Fargo since the September 8th settlement announcement over the fake accounts issue. You know, the bank is under scrutiny for practices around fees to extend the interest rate lock periods for residential mortgages. It's under scrutiny for practices related to identity theft and debt protection products.
And insurance.
And auto insurance, right? And then also freezing and closing consumer deposit accounts after the company detected suspected fraudulent activity. So I think the combination of, you know, the really low votes at the shareholder meeting this past April in Jacksonville, Florida, all these new revelations, it's just kind of piled up. And I think Wells Fargo realizes that what they've done so far, you know, John Stumpf leaving and some other changes that they've made within the consumer bank to turn themselves around, I think they've realized that it's not enough. Yeah. It's not enough for public perception, perhaps. It's not enough for investors and not enough for politicians like Elizabeth Warren and Maxine Waters out of California.
And other people on the board are scheduled to retire. Is that voluntary or is this another instance of them realizing that they need to have a change at the bank if the bank is going to recover from this? Stacey?
There are several that are hitting retirement age in the next couple of years, but I think there is also a movement among some of the directors to voluntarily head out the door a little sooner than they might otherwise.
You wrote in the New York Times, Stacey, that Wells Fargo has been reeling since its admission in September that over several years, employees trying to meet aggressive sales quotas opened as many as several million fraudulent bank accounts. What do you mean by reeling? How has that exemplified itself?
I think you certainly see that their customer reputation has taken a real hit. I mean, one of the startling aspects of this is the amount of actual harm caused to customers is fairly minor in financial terms. We're talking about a couple of million dollars in lost fees and things like that. But the amount of damage it's done to the bank's reputation has just been absolutely enormous. And they're really struggling to get past that. And as noted, it's just this continued drip, drip, drip of bad news. I was speaking to someone recently who said they're like a deer separated from the herd. They're now in like the target of every, you know, regulator, every aggrieved customer. Everyone is looking for every little misstep at that bank.
And the and these customers, I'm sure they're using all kinds of forensic accounting to find out who was hurt and how badly they were hurt. Have they all been made whole? Will they all be made whole?
Well, so far, the bank has provided customer refunds or payments to the tune of about $5 million. And there's also a class action settlement that's still in the, you know, court approval still in the works for that. That's $142 million in relief. But in the next couple of weeks, there's this expanded review that the bank has undertaken to see just how many more fake accounts, potential fake accounts might have, you know, might be out there. And what the bank recently said this month was that this expanded review, quote, may lead to, close quote, a significant increase. And significant was the bank's word, a significant increase. So, you know, you're talking already about 2.1 million, I believe the number is, potentially fake accounts. And what does a significant increase mean? That's
so this is coming from their, the bank's own internal investigation, this hypothesis that perhaps a significantly larger number of instances of this bogus account scandal will come to light.
It's a third party doing the work, but yes.
And on top of that, the insurance scandal recently came out into the open where they hundreds of thousands of customers may have been charged premiums for insurance that they did not need, and those practices may have led to vehicle repossessions that might not have otherwise occurred. Stacy, just how unprecedented is this sort of thing at a major bank, or at a small bank for that matter?
Well, we've certainly had any number of dramatic banking scandals over recent years. I mean, plenty of them have done some pretty terrible things during the financial crisis. But one thing that this one really highlights is how much this is affecting retail investors, and it's very simple. This is not involving complex schemes. This is something that anyone can understand, you know, fake accounts, unwanted products. And I think that's part of where the outrage over it comes from. This is not some elaborate machination. This was just straight up terrible behavior.
When you have a combination of these unscrupulous practices at the same time, in the same institution, at various different departments in that institution that may or may not be connected or even talking to each other, does that indicate that the whole place is rotten, or that they're just there were policies in place that forced people to be, for lack of a better word, rotten to save their own skin?
I think that's one of the things they're trying to come to grips with now. And I've probably talked to hundreds of employees in recent months, and over, you hear what a toll this has taken on them. Lots of people who have left the bank. I mean, employees, especially those who left, tended to know that this was wrong. And they really were frustrated to be caught in that culture and being pushed by their bosses to do things that they felt was unethical. So even beyond the toll this has taken on customers, you really see how it's affected their workforce.
And Dion, you talk to these people at the retail level, I'm sure at the executive level too, but at the retail level within Wells Fargo, which used to be in this town, Wachovia, we were told at the time of the merger, which came at a very bad time in Wachovia's life, it was a do or die situation, that this was going to be a good combination of corporate cultures, because Wachovia always wore the white hat, they were good guys, and Wells Fargo had this reputation on the West Coast of being the white hat guys, and this was going to be good. What was the reaction? When did local people, Wachovia people, First Union people, notice that this was not all kosher?
I think they, you know, noticed it. Some people I've spoken to noticed right away when the bank, you know, converted systems from Wachovia to Wells Fargo. You know, I've spoken to old Wachovia employees, legacy Wachovia employees, who kind of noticed a change pretty quickly in how Wells Fargo was approaching sales and how, you know, high their goals were and targets were for sales, and it felt different. So right away, I think people sensed that this was going to be maybe a bit more of a, you know, aggressive sales culture than what they might have been used to at Wachovia.
Elizabeth Duke will succeed Mr. Stanger as chair of the board of Wells Fargo. She will be the only female chairman of a major bank in the country, but perhaps more significant, she comes from the bank that Wells Fargo rushed in to save with their stagecoach. During the banking crisis, Wachovia. Wachovia, as I just mentioned, had a sterling reputation in terms of how it operated. Will she bring a Wachovia culture to Wells? Stacy.
Well, we'll see. I mean, the other thing that gives people some hope is she certainly has an extensive regulatory background, being a former Federal Reserve governor. So I think the expectation and hope is that she'll have a better sense of what sorts of things they need to do to get themselves back out of the regulatory crosshairs.
Well,
it also gives people some confidence that she's fairly new. She only joined the board last year. So even though she came in at the tail end of this, she was not there through that whole long culture of ignoring these problems.
And she replaces Mr. Sanger, who's a retired chairman and CEO of General Mills, which is a cereal company. Of course, his predecessor, John Stumpf, was a banker. Does it matter that a banker is in charge of a bank that's so deeply in trouble and needs to extricate itself from that trouble?
I don't think it matters that everyone on the board has banking experience. I mean, a company as big as Wells Fargo and as complex as Wells Fargo, you need people with, you know, diverse backgrounds in technology, risk management. You know, certainly you do want some banking expertise. I will say that, you know, what's interesting is you still see elected officials like Elizabeth Warren writing letters to Janet Yellen saying, you know, we need to remove 12 more members of the board right after Wells Fargo announced that Sanger was stepping down. Next day, Elizabeth Warren sent a letter, which I think was her third letter since June, saying, look, we need to remove 12 members of the board. And Maxine Waters, who's a Democrat on the House side, also the next day, she said that this change was a, quote, superficial change in leadership, and it wouldn't be enough to restore the trust and confidence of the American public in Wells Fargo, which she called, quote, a recidivist institution that has committed millions of crimes and shows no remorse.
Is she right about that?
Well, I mean, you know, some of this is probably political grandstanding, but, you know,
How does the corporation show remorse other than investigating itself, admitting to its crimes, and making the customers who were cheated whole?
One thing that's driving this frustration is, again, this drip, drip, drip of bad news. Something like the insurance scandal, all signs were that they knew about that for more than a year. They had internal reports on it. And that came to light because people involved in this got frustrated that the bank wasn't moving more quickly to fix what it knew was a problem. So I think that drives some of that populist outrage of, it's been almost a year. Why are we still finding out about things that you internally knew were going on?
Yeah.
Also, the auto insurance thing that we're talking about, which was first reported on by the New York Times in July, the bank admitted and then apologized about that incident after the New York Times got a copy of an internal report. So I think it was like, wait a minute, there's another thing here that we didn't know about in the public, and now the bank is apologizing for this new thing. So the bank knew about it. They had this report. It was this extensive report. It was leaked to the New York Times.
Who's keeping them honest on these things that are finally coming out? We are learning more things, and they're not nice and not pretty. But how do we know what they may be holding back?
Well, that's the problem. That report was leaked to us by people who knew it existed and were frustrated that the bank had been sitting on it for so long. So to some degree, we're back in this whistleblower culture of, you know, it's going to depend on regulators and, you know, individual employees to speak out about what they know.
So I think I heard you say, Dion, that this has cost the bank more than several hundred million dollars in restitution, et cetera. But to a bank the size of Wells Fargo, several hundred million dollars is like pocket change, it seems to me. The damage to their reputation, has it been significantly greater than that? Have they lost a significant number of customers or deposits, or have people paid off their loans and moved on to other banks? What has happened as a result of this?
You know, I hear from customers who, you know, have told me that they're leaving Wells Fargo, they're going to a credit union, so they're stepping, you know, down from a big bank to a much smaller institution. But as far as the fallout for the bank, you know, financially, you're right. I mean, it's sort of a rounding error, you know, these millions of dollars for a bank that makes billions of dollars a quarter. But, you know, you look at the stock price, for example. All of the big banks, their stocks are up this year, you know, riding these expectations of deregulation under the Trump administration and higher interest rates. But Wells Fargo stock is down, so it's an outlier. So the shareholders don't like that. And then also, you know, some executives have been toppled, and some board members have been toppled.
How did they get away? So many people were hurt by this in various different areas of their banking relationship with Wells. How did they get away with this for so long without the whistle being blown by customers, Stacey?
Customers tried. I mean, we certainly heard from any number of customers who said, I've been making complaints, I've been trying to get attention to this. But it also points to some regulatory failures. I mean, the OCC, which is the main federal bank overseer, came out and said, we made mistakes on this. They didn't take it seriously. So I think it's also a real wake-up call about the institutions that are supposed to be monitoring this need to do a better job of it.
How do you repair this? How does a bank, how does any business repair these things where they have deliberately, apparently, hurt their own customers?
Well, I think it's a matter of time. It's a matter of, you know, just being very, I think, you know, out there public about the, you know, the fact that you're sorry and that, you know, you're making changes and you're taking steps.
How do you demonstrate that you're sorry? Waive ATM fees?
No,
lower your interest rates.
I mean, I think it's just, you know, treating their customers well going forward and being upfront and honest and, you know, not having things revealed through leaks to media outlets, but maybe being a little more proactive about getting things out there. You know, before it's leaked.
And
the front line in that is their customer, is their employees. They're the ones that they really need to win back even more than the customers. We hear so many employees who are just desperate for a leadership culture that really does prioritize doing the right thing.
Stacey Cowley is a consumer finance reporter for the New York Times, who has written extensively on the Wells Fargo situation, as has Dion Roberts, a banking reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you both for filling us in on what's next. When's the next shoe drop? Do we know? When's that next report come out?
In several weeks, we'll get the report on the expanded review of their accounts.
Okay. Thank you both for being here.